This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
And now that heart is beating fast, and that's the rhythm I can dance to. I'm mighty glad I've got a chance to, that one big heart that's beating fast. Tomorrow morning, let it rain. Tomorrow morning, let it pour. Tonight we're in the groove together. Ain't gonna worry about stormy weather. Gonna kick old trouble out the door. Beat out old trouble and drunk. Beat out old trouble and drunk. Beat out old trouble on the drum and kick old trouble out the door. Beat me that rhythm on the drum. Beat me that rhythm on the drum. Beat me that rhythm on the drum and kick old trouble out the door. Kick him 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 out the
Welcome to Radical Australian Community Radio 3CR. Our producer, Henrietta, once again refuses to talk. So in her place, we have Mr. Thomas Cooper, commonly known as around the traps as Tom. Tom, this is a live interview. There's no point smiling at me. Say hello.
Hello, Joseph. Hello, listeners.
Good. Now, look, we're going to start at the very beginning, and because the radicals aren't born, they're made, aren't they?
Okay.
Would you agree with that statement? Radicals are made, not born?
It's the first time I've heard that, but yeah.
It's an original. It's an original thought.
Yep. No, events shape us.
So where were you born?
I was born at just around the corner from here in East Melbourne at the Mercy Hospital.
My son was born at the Mercy Hospital, so we've got something in common. Yep. And what year were you born?
1950, mid-century, baby.
I'm going to have to be kind to you because you're my elder.
Thank you.
That's what I found out when you were down at the Parliament House on the public housing vigil, that you were the oldest bastard on the line.
Thank you, and I appreciated the respect.
Yes. So, what was your mum called?
Lillian.
And do you remember her maiden name?
It was Waterfield.
Right. And your dad, what was his name?
Daniel Cooper.
Cooper. He's not part of the famous Indigenous Cooper clan, was he?
No, but I'm glad to share the same name.
So obviously he came down from a long line of Coopers, did he?
He wasn't a brewer or a barrel maker.
Yep.
He was born in Birmingham, England, and came out to Tasmania when he was 16 with his dad. Family had soldier settler land down there, tried to make a go of that.
Yep.
And my mum was born in Liverpool in 1917. She came out to Australia decidedly younger than my dad, when she was about 3 or 4. And
They're not the ubiquitous 10-pound Poms that came after World War II. They came after World War I.
Correct.
How come he got a soldier settlement? Did he fight with the Australian forces?
Yeah, I don't know. He's my granddad was training troops in England.
So maybe he was training some of the Australians?
He could have, yeah.
Did you ever meet your grandparents?
No.
Never?
Predeceased me.
Right. And what was your father's main occupation?
He was a physiotherapist.
In those days, that's a pretty prestigious position.
He was one of the very first physios, I think. 1926, he was at Melbourne Uni.
Right. That's extraordinary. That's almost a century ago. It is a century ago.
It is.
It is.
Well done.
We've discovered something.
Congratulations.
Yeah, it's 100 years.
And I think that year he won the heavyweight boxing championship.
Melbourne University.
He was a light heavyweight.
Right.
He got beaten by John Rossiter.
Right.
And got his nose broken by John Rossiter. And he thought, oh, damn this, I've done all the training. I'll go into the heavyweight. And he won the heavyweight.
Right. Well,
he was also a painter and a poet and a fisherman. Right.
I'm a bit concerned. I was going to ask you what he's like. What was he like as a dad?
Oh, he was gentle. He wasn't. He was a classical violinist.
Oh, right.
Unusual for a boxer.
Yeah.
But he didn't keep the boxing up all
It's what we'd call in the old days a Renaissance man.
That's what his daughter called him.
A Renaissance man.
Yep.
Yep. So how many siblings have you got now that you brought in your daughter?
Well, my sister. My dad was married, first marriage, he had a daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Second marriage, I was born. So my sister Leonie was born 20 years before me.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really catch up with her until I was about 18 or 19.
Right.
She married an American diplomat, and she travelled a lot around the world in different places.
Mm-hmm.
He might have been a diplomat, or he might have been a spy.
Who knows? Doesn't matter, does it? He's dead.
I think
he's still alive.
He might be still alive, but my sister's not. She died 20 years ago.
20 years ago, right. What was life like for a young lad in those days, in the late 50s, you know, when you were going to primary school?
It was idyllic. I was the only child there at home with lovely parents living in Canterbury.
Oh, very nice.
And this was before it was Kylie Minogue, McMansions.
Right.
And it was still, you know, at the time I didn't realise that I was so fortunate where I was living, but it was just delightful. But I didn't really like school that much.
Why not?
Probably for my ADHD or something, I couldn't focus. But each year, when I was asked, how do you like it? And I said, no, I don't like it. And he said, they'd send me to another school.
Right, right.
So I was at Baldwin State School for a year, and then I was at Carey Baptist Grammar School for a year.
Well, that's unfortunate because you don't make lasting friendships, do you?
And then I went at seven, went to Geelong.
Geelong.
And boarded.
You boarded?
At Geelong Grammar
School. How old were you?
Seven.
Seven?
Yeah.
Geelong Grammar?
Yeah.
Where the king went.
Where it was just a prince then.
It was just a prince, yeah. You're right. You've pulled me up there. That's correct.
The King Charles III.
Yes. So you went to Geelong Grammar, so obviously.
For 9 years, yeah.
As a boarder?
As a boarder.
And your parents lived in Melbourne?
Yes.
I won't ask why.
Yeah, because I don't know. But I think it came back to the fact that my dad really believed in it. Education as being really, really important.
Mm.
I think he got sold on the prospectus.
Right.
And because he was at a grammar school in Birmingham in his matriculation year, when his dad said, oh, we're moving. He said, oh, where are we moving to? He said, Tasmania.
Right.
In 1920. That was a pretty rough move.
It would have been.
And
long sea voyage.
But working on the farm for a couple of years, didn't see a penny.
Hmm.
And when he was asked, well, what do you want to do for the rest of your life? He said, I don't know, but I know I don't want to milk bloody cows.
Yeah, well, it was very, very forward thinking of him. A lot of people don't want to milk cows, but they still do.
Yep.
Not by hand, and by machine.
Very glad, glad of their milk.
Yeah. Now, Geelong Grammar, as a boarder.
As a boarder.
What was that like?
1958, I didn't like it.
You didn't like much about your schooling, did you?
No. No.
Any particular reason you didn't like it? Did they have hazing in those days, I assume?
What's hazing, sorry?
You know, when you get inducted into the brotherhood, when they play tricks on you, you know, like pour excrement over your head and all those type of things, you know, that young lads used to do at these private schools.
Initiations.
Yes, yes.
And that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
No, not really. It was talked about and sort of scared of that may be happening. You know,
right.
When you went from junior school up to middle school, or running the gauntlets, or different things that you would imagine in your mind might happen. But no, I just didn't want to be there. So I didn't put down any roots, didn't make friends really readily. I just had a few
How many years were you there?
Nine,
and you hardly made any friends.
Well, I did have, I made some good friends, a couple of good friends, yeah.
Particularly,
Michael Hansen, who was really particularly good at befriending and supporting outsiders.
Right, right. Okay, doesn't sound like a idyllic life, does
it? Fun time. No, it has everything except love.
Except love. Care, discipline, food, order.
Yeah.
All those things.
Bed and books and beatings.
Oh, well, beatings are in
Still in favour.
Still in favour. Was it the strap or the cane or both?
Oh, I can remember getting hit by a slipper.
Right.
On the bare ass in front of this master's girlfriend.
Oh, right. Sounds like some type
of... It's a bit kinky.
Yeah, sounds a bit kinky, yeah.
An arrow.
What, was shot at you?
Used as a cane.
Oh, as a cane, right.
You'd go...
With the pointy end.
Selection.
Yeah.
Pick a cane out of these three canes, and bend over the Chesterfield.
Yeah.
I remember getting caned a couple of times by the father of the... what's he called? Deputy Prime Minister, Minister for Defence.
I can't remember who that was.
Mr. Miles,
yeah. It sounds like a pornographic show. You're bent over the Chesterfield, then caned. Leather. Leather on leather.
Rain is ingesting.
How did you escape when you got 16? What, you just left school or did you?
Well, I failed leaving.
You failed.
And they
said, the door's there. We don't talk to
you. No. The headmaster was saying, no, you're too immature to leave.
Right.
You should stay and
do another year.
And I said, no, I've had enough.
Right.
And I just wanted to grow my hair. Now I haven't got any.
No, I've noticed.
But, I just wanted to get out of there. There was too much sort of snide bullying and... carrying on, and I seemed to be too often in fights. I had a short fuse, and people would tease me and mock me and stuff like that. And I'd think, well, I know I hate being called that.
So
they're looking for trouble.
Yeah.
Not that, you know, I was any good at that sort of stuff.
You didn't get any lessons from your father?
He tried to teach me the gentlemanly art of self-defence.
That's right. In other words, using your fists in the appropriate manner.
He was more in favour of using your feet to get away
and
get away from fights. He said that was the first thing. If you can't get out of it, then you have to...
You begin to understand why a lot of our leaders in those days would have gone through the same type of schooling and how it affects people. Yeah. So what did you do once you left? You didn't matriculate or...?
No, I've tried a few times. I went to Taylor's, George Taylor and Son, in the city.
And what did they do?
That was a finishing school for elite private schools. It used to be called public schools in my day.
I assume you didn't do typing in shorthand and dressmaking?
No, that probably would have served me well. But I managed to get through the fifth form, year 11, leaving. Then I started a hotel management course at William Anglis.
Right.
And I felt like, no, I had a tiny little English cooking instructor who got a set against me because I was tall.
Right.
And I thought, no, I'm going to get out of here. And the idea was that if I did that for 2 years, I'd end up with enough matriculation things so that I could get into uni.
All right. Did you ever get into uni?
No.
No. So what does a lad do? Obviously your parents are a little bit disappointed. They might not have shown it, but they're a bit disappointed.
My mum died when I was 12.
Right.
So
she
was never disappointed in me.
No. Well, that's lovely to know.
Yeah.
What was she like as a mum?
She was just the best.
Right. So what, you'd go home for holidays or you'd stay
come home at term, end of terms and summer holiday.
Right.
I think you got 3 exits a term.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right. What, 17, 18?
Yeah, I went up to, I hopped on a plane and went up to Darwin to work in a, and end up working in a brick factory.
In a brick factory?
Yeah, out past the airport on the way to the showgrounds, yeah.
Can I ask why you went to Darwin in 1968? Any particular reason?
I suppose to get as far away as possible.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I was looking at even maybe going to Weeper and working over there, and I'm glad I didn't.
Right.
Taking that land away.
Right.
So I was there for a while. I put my age up from 17 to 19 to get a few more dollars.
Yep.
And then I got a letter from the government that said, oh, you're 19, about to turn 20, so you better register for national service. And I said, oh, see ya.
See ya. So. Excuse me. I'm not in the company of one of those people, am I? A traitor?
I was only 17.
Oh, you're only 17. Oh, so did your marble ever come up?
No, I didn't register for
it. You didn't register.
Service. I was working at the rail, you know, a couple of years later when that was on the cards.
Right.
So
right.
I spoke with a, used to talk with a few anarchists down there at the, on the rail.
Yeah, I remember that in the '70s. Yeah. And what did they tell you to do? What would they suggest?
A couple of suggestions. Yeah. You can either participate, and if you're called up, you can, you know, refuse to be a conscientious objector, or you can just not acknowledge and recognise that there's any validity in the whole thing and just ignore it.
So what did you decide to do?
I ignored it.
And what happened?
Well, nothing much. I mean, I just, yeah, well, maybe I am one of those people. Because... a while after that time expired, I'd managed to get myself a passport early on.
Right.
And I think Tullamarine just opened as an airport.
Mm-hmm.
And I skedaddled past a fellow on the desk there who didn't really have a close enough examination of my passport to see whether I'd actually been cleared by the National Service. And anyway,
stamped your passport.
Yeah,
off
so
you
I
went.
Got on the plane. And it was like, whew.
Right.
So I'd been worried about it since I was 16.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You realise you'd be in good company in Bali today. You know why?
Why's that?
There's a lot of those chaps from Russia and the Ukraine.
Oh.
Who find themselves in Bali because obviously...
They'd rather not be in a war zone.
Well, not just that. I mean, what are you fighting for?
Yeah.
That's the key. What are you fighting for? And obviously you're a lad that was thinking, you know. Remember what Muhammad Ali said?
Yeah.
He said, was it no Viet Cong's...
Ever called me a nigger.
Yeah. All right, so did you fly back to the old Dart, did you?
I did.
You did, yeah. Do you know what the old Dart is, Henrietta? She does, so that's nice to know. She's one of us. And what did you do in England?
I caught up with an old mate of mine who I'd been at Taylor's with in London, and then an old friend of mine, a really, really good friend, Colin, who's passed away since then, New Zealander. I was up in Birmingham, and I went up there, and I went to the Isle of Wight Pop Festival and saw Jimi Hendrix and The Who and all the people that were playing at that stage.
So you were there that particular time?
In August 1970.
In August 1970. Did you cross the famous crossing?
Across to the Isle of Wight?
No, down in London, the famous, you know, the one on the record covers, the crossing.
Oh, actually, funny, I was staying with my friend John Barlow, who was in Maida Vale or St John's Wood, and unbeknownst to me, it was just around the corner from the Abbey Studios, and in the next street parallel was Paul McCartney's house, where the girls used to stand outside the house all day.
Did any of them stand outside your house?
No.
So you haven't got a voice for singing?
Oh, I've got a beautiful singing voice, Joseph.
Really?
Like yourself.
Yeah. Like myself. Oh, yeah. That's brilliant. All right, so how long did you last in... Did you go to Europe after that, after you went to England?
Not much. I went to Paris and
You just sound like a normal layabout Australian, you know. Yeah. You just go to England just to get, you know, not be conscripted, have a good time, go to festivals. Yeah. And we blame the young today, you know.
I went to the first, or it was actually maybe the second, Glastonbury Festival in June 1971.
Right.
And that was amazing because it was free and there were 12,000 people there. And, yeah, it was life-changing.
Mm. How was it life-changing?
Well, I heard I think he was a 13-year-old Indian boy got on stage and said, what you're looking for is within you, and if you need help to find it, I'm only too happy to help you. And this was like news to my ears. Everyone was, I'd seen Billy Graham like about a year or so before in Melbourne at the My Music Bowl, and the story there was you come forward, you give yourself and da-da-da, and when you die, you'll go to heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And here was someone saying, actually, what you're looking for is here now, right inside of you. And it doesn't, it's no cost, you know, la-di-da-di-da. And I was very interested because it was like
You're not going to tell me you went to India.
Not there and then, no.
Not there and then, all right. Okay, so did you come back home to Australia?
I did, yeah. After I think I was writing a letter to my dad in the backyard. I was on mescaline and I was writing a different coloured pencil or pen for each word, and he wrote back and said, I think you're in trouble, Tom.
Come home.
Nothing's quite not near, yeah. So he put the doubt into me, you know. It's like, I was all right until then.
Oh, you know, multicoloured writing, what's wrong with that?
Yeah.
I mean, for a man from his era, he would have been shocked to his boots.
I guess.
So you came back and what did you do?
Actually, I did come back through India, that's right.
Yeah. I knew you would because you've got this 13-year-old boy.
I flew to Karachi, I went up to Afghanistan, I bought a few goods. Came back through Pakistan and got relieved of my goods at the airport, just going into India.
Right.
I didn't realise it, but the 13-year-old boy, Prem Rawat, was near Delhi at that same time, but I didn't know it till later on. But there was sort of a parallel thing going on until I finally really checked it out when I came back to Melbourne.
What do you mean you checked it out? What did you check out, Tom?
Well, I went to listen to what was being said about, you know, what was being offered.
Who was talking? Who was offering? Was it a particular group or particular?
Yeah, at the time it used to be called Divine Light Mission.
Right.
And Prem Rawat was known as Guru Maharaji.
Right.
The young Indian guru.
Mm.
And the boy guru, and people who'd been involved with him previously, and having an experience that he was talking about, would speak, and it was like, oh, okay, so this is practical. It's not a question of belief; it's a question of knowing.
Right.
So, I listened for some time, for some months. Then an instructor arrived from India. And showed us what it was about.
So what was it about?
Well, it's about you. It's
about yourself.
That, yeah.
Mm.
It's about myself.
Do you think it was? Do you think
it was a way of going inside and experiencing something inside you? Which
do, do you still have that same
practice?
Practice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a daily.
Hasn't changed. So you say it's a daily practice. What do you do?
What does it involve?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, there's four techniques which sit down and practice those techniques. And,
What are they? Physical techniques like breathing, that type of stuff? Or
it's not a thinking process. It's
right. And you found that liberating?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Right. Okay. What did the people around you think of all this?
Well, my dad wasn't over-impressed.
No. He's come back.
There was a lot of Indian stuff that came with it in those days.
Yeah.
And, you have to leave your shoes downstairs and climb these stairs at 322 Brunswick Street, Fitzroy.
Right.
And and he had bad rheumatoid arthritis, but he took his shoes off and struggled up the stairs and sat on a chair at the back and listened.
Just like a good dad, yeah.
Like a good dad, keeping an eye out for me.
Yeah, true. All right, well, this is very unusual. Not strange, but unusual. Obviously, everybody gets their kicks in different ways, Tom. Now, so what have you been doing for the last 50 years? What type of...
I've had many, many, many different jobs.
Like what?
Clerical work.
Right.
Sales work.
Sales work. You wouldn't be very good at that, would you? You're not the type that wants to sell shit to people.
Not brilliant.
No, because you've got an ethical basis, obviously.
Yeah. And it's very unsatisfying because even if you happen to be doing well, there's someone to say, yes, you did well, Tom, but, you know, you could have done a lot better if you'd just done this and this. And it's like you never get
never
to
enough,
savour at anything, you know.
So did you just get paid on, did you get paid on commission or just the commission on the sales, or did you get paid a wage?
A wage and then bonuses.
Bonuses on top of them. What were you selling, just out of interest?
Art materials.
Oh, that's reasonable. At least you weren't selling vacuum cleaners.
Or missiles.
Or missiles, yeah. Yeah, you would have got made much more money if you're selling missiles, mate, especially these days.
The dirtier the job, the more the money is.
That's right. So, salesman, what else?
I worked in health.
Doing what?
Oh, I worked as a nurse's assistant. I worked in a...
How many years did you do that for?
Well, a lot of my work was pretty short term, you know.
What, they gave you the arse or you gave them the arse?
Often got the sack, yeah.
Why?
I don't know, but it might have something to do with my ADHD.
Right.
But...
Now, you say you've got ADHD. What makes you think you've got ADHD? I mean, has it been officially diagnosed or is that your diagnosis?
No, it's officially diagnosed.
Right. And how old were you when the diagnosis was made?
Oh, about 10 years ago.
And has that made a difference to your life, having the diagnosis?
Diagnosis and medications.
Yeah. And do you think it's made a big difference to your life?
Yeah. And I think if I'd been able to, if I was aware of that as a young person,
right,
I would have been able to adjust and do different things. And these days... people are assisted, you know, in school and what have you.
Yeah,
But I did whatever job I could get that didn't require a degree or a diploma or this and that, because I was really hopeless at passing exams.
Right.
I used to really go to war. Right. Yeah.
So what made you seek a diagnosis? Had things come to a really critical stage in your life?
Oh, gosh, you're asking me to remember. That's one thing that I'm not so hot on. Oh, there's a couple of medications that I'm on which affect my memory.
Memory, right.
Methotrexate.
Right.
Da-di-da. Okay.
Now, I'm fascinated because I've heard this story over and over again. People get diagnosed in later life and it's if a door is opened
for them.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what they say, a door's opened, I'm a different person, I can do things and I'm much happier.
Yeah, I think I need tweaking still.
Right. You're getting a bit long in the tooth to be tweaked.
I'm still, a friend's sister used to call me when I was really quite young, Messy Tom.
Messy Tom.
And sadly, I'm still in that state, but I just...
Tom, I don't think that's anything to worry about, being messy. You look sartorially elegant. He's got a... You know, he's got a Palestinian shawl, scarf.
Yes.
He's got a public housing, bright public house, safe public housing T-shirt, a very nice blue jacket, matching blue pants, jeans, I think, with black boots. He has his nice glasses and a bald head. You look.
What more could you?
You look. Well, that's right. You look. You look like a respected elder.
Good. Just don't tell anybody.
I won't tell anybody. So, how difficult was it before the diagnosis in terms of paying the rent? You know, doing things that people normally do.
Oh, I'd hold on to jobs for, you know, quite a few years.
All right, yeah.
Times. They weren't just for a couple of weeks.
Right.
Yeah, it's a steady earner and what have you, but things that, the wheels that fall off sometimes.
Right, right. What do you mean the wheels that fall off? What, you just...
I seem to have difficulty with authority.
You know what you've got. You haven't got ADHD. You've got ADS. Have you heard of ADS?
ADS?
Yeah. Authority Defiance Syndrome.
Ah.
It has been recognised as a psychiatric condition.
It's in
so
the
not
book.
Only do you got
is
ADHD.
It in the book?
Was that treatable? No. The only way it's treatable is to become a revolutionary.
Well, that sounds like a good
well, haven't your therapist talked to you about ADF, Authority Defiance Syndrome? That's what they have jails for.
Yeah.
For people like you, you know?
Oh, don't tempt them.
So, you think it's because of your experiences as a child, or do you think it's just innate in you, this authority defiance syndrome?
Look, I'm not quite sure, but don't like to just accept what people tell you to accept without any sort of credibility.
Lucky you left Australia before you were conscripted. You would have made a terrible conscript.
Yeah, I wouldn't have had a good time.
I don't think you would have passed the pass physical muster. That's very good. Pass muster, that's what they say. He didn't pass muster, and that meant that he didn't have to die for his country. all right. Now, I understand you live in public housing.
I do.
You're one of the 2% left in public housing in this state.
Is that right? Just 2%?
2%. Used to be 15. It's down to 2% of the population. Very small numbers. Now, how did you get into the public housing system?
Well, I was... you find yourself homeless.
So you got to the stage where you're homeless?
Virtually, yeah.
And how long was that for, that you were homeless?
Oh, as long as I, you know, longer than I wanted.
As long as you wanted to.
Longer than I wanted.
Longer than you wanted to, yeah.
But, I got in touch with...
Right, I just want to go back to this. Yeah, when you say you were homeless, were you sleeping on the streets?
No, I wasn't sleeping rough.
Right,
so
what was what?
Different
just,
places. Like
right, so couch surfing.
Yeah, my friends, you know, renting here and there.
Right.
A garage. And,
right, the back cash payments and all that stuff. Yeah. So, what do you remember? Was this in your 50s, your 60s, that you found yourself in this situation?
I should have taken a sort of some sort of pill to boost my memory before.
No. So, but you're middle-aged.
I'm 75.
I know you're 75 now, going on to 76, but I'm just saying, the period you were homeless, were you in your 40s, your 50s, or?
No, more recent.
More recent,
yeah.
Right. So how difficult was it for you to get a roof over your head in public housing?
Well, it was pretty difficult, and it took a few years.
Took a few years.
Yes.
Now, could you tell us about the process? Because I think a lot of people think, oh, you know, you get a house like that. They forget there's a waiting list of years and years and years.
Yeah. So I went to a number of different housing associations,
right,
groups and places all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Then eventually through City of Port Phillip and Jeff Lyons, rest in peace.
Who was Jeff Lyons?
He was a terrific local organizer and very good man with the council and stuff, and a great advisor to a number of activists.
So what was he, kind of a street worker, was he?
He was helping people find, you know, helping with the paperwork and stuff like that in housing. And Kate in SETI, different ones. And I was sent, offered a place in Williamstown Road. I can't live here. It's just, I don't know this area at all. I don't have transport. And it just, not for me.
Ungrateful. That's what people would say.
Offered,
but you've got three choices. That's what people forget.
Then it was suggested maybe a boarding house, and I said no.
Yeah.
And I said, fair enough, I don't see you in a boarding house.
That's your second strike, three strikes and you're out.
And I think some people are threatened with two strikes and you're out these days.
These days, yeah.
But when I was shown my this unit up at 150 Inkerman Street, I was just wrapped to the eyeballs.
Excuse me. Inkerman Street.
St Kilda, yeah.
Prime real estate.
Absolutely.
And we've got people like you
living
in prime real estate in Inkerman Street.
Inkerman Street.
This can't be allowed to go on, Tom.
Well, it is.
It is. So, okay, see, this is what people forget. It's not just the roof over your head. It's about all the connections you have to the people around you, the organisations and all that. It's not just about getting another roof over your head in Morwell or Bacchus Marsh or something like that. All right, so how long have you been living in the unit at Inkerman Street?
I think it's about 8 years.
8 years. And is it a bedsitter? It's a bedsitter. So basically you've got toilet in the corner, shower...
It's got a bathroom.
A bathroom. You've got a separate bathroom.
Come in this little kitchen.
Right.
And a window with a view out over the city skyline and then into a room.
Right.
It's got your bed and your record player and stuff.
Stuff like that. All right. This is in Inkerman Street.
In Inkerman.
And how many of you chappies and chappesses are living there these days?
It's about 100.
100. So what? It's about 40 to 50 units?
There's 100 units.
100 units. So it's basically for single people,
Mostly single people there. There's some couples there.
Is it an over 55?
It's over 55.
Right. So we've got these elderly people like yourself, Tom. We've had a tough time in life, right? You needed security.
All's well that ends well.
Well, it hasn't ended.
I know.
That's what we're getting to, Tom. I know things that our listeners don't know, and I'm going to drag it out of you. All right, so you're having a nice time. You're enjoying the amenities. You're going down to the beach. Do you go down to the beach?
Occasionally.
All right.
I play tennis. Yeah.
What club?
I go to a thing called Rally Forever, which is a Thursday and a Friday in East Melbourne and in South Yarra. And it's a really, really great idea that was set up by Louise. Because saying that in this day and age that loneliness and isolation is a huge problem, and to get people to come together and have a hit of tennis... they might think about, I'd like to join a tennis club, but it's a bit hard and I don't know anyone there and what have you, but it's a social thing.
And the fees are a bit high.
Yeah, and this is free.
Right.
And this is like, come together, play these games. And the object of the exercise is that everybody has a good time. It's not competitive and beat the other person. If the other person has a good time, you're winning.
Right.
And so it's just try to have rallies and... do that for an hour, and then people bring snacks and things, and we have a lunch together and socialise. And I was amazed at how quickly people make friends.
Yeah,
it's really, really good. So that's it on a Thursday in East Melbourne, Powlett Street, and Friday morning, 11 o'clock in Toorak Road,
Brian?
Faulkner Park.
Faulkner Park, yeah. Well, it's interesting. It's a little bit like the vigils at Parliament House steps. It's been going on now for over eight years. People meet, they get to meet other people, like-minded people, then they go and have lunch.
Yes.
So the actual...
Similar
thing.
Yeah.
But a little bit more sedentary than hitting a tennis ball out for a net.
Well, it's great to have it. The beauty of this tennis thing is that you're exercising, but you're not really conscious of the fact that you're exercising. You're just focusing on the ball, and it feels good when you hit it in the middle of the racket. And it's like, it's a thrill. It's great. And in no time, you're friends with all these people, and you're rotating through.
Mm.
And they have a couple of tennis instructor people there who run like the games and the circuits. Mm. And
sounds like speed dating for old people who play tennis.
I haven't been to speed dating, Joseph. What's it like?
Like what you're suggesting. You know, you meet a lot of people. All right. So here you are. You're living a reasonable lifestyle. Obviously, you're on a social security benefit because of your old age. You're getting by.
Yep.
And what happens?
Well, yes, out of the blue.
Out of the blue. What, God comes down? Yeah.
No.
What happens out of the blue?
Out of the blue, you get the news that there's a knock at the door. Go to the door. There's someone from Housing Victoria who says, oh, I'm so-and-so, and these buildings are coming down, so everyone here will be moving somewhere else.
And this happened what? Just near Christmas, to make it interesting?
I can't remember.
That's what happened in Kensington. It was at Christmas that they told.
Christmas
present. Yeah, okay. Down at Barrack Beacon.
Were they
just
as Santa?
Yeah, just before Christmas at Barrack Beacon. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what happened.
Mrs. Claus.
Yeah, yeah.
This is your
and present. You had no prior notification, no idea.
Well, we were, I just said, no. And I'd heard that there was a thing about 44 towers coming down. I'd heard that there was, we'd been led to believe, or, you know, we led ourselves to believe that we were sort of last on the list. And then all of a sudden it got reversed, and seven estates that were for older people came first.
You'd be first on the list.
You'd be first, the first to be last.
You don't understand capitalism, all right? You didn't do Economics 101 at university. You are sitting on prime real estate.
Absolutely.
We could build 1,000 units.
Yeah.
We could set aside 5% and give it to social housing, but we're going to send you to Morwell. I've got nothing against Morwell, but... So...
Well, if you want to get more well.
Right. So what you said, no. Did they call the police and take you away in chains?
No, they just walked away.
They walked away. Did they give you a piece of paper, anything?
No.
Just a verbal message. We're going to get rid of you bastards and, you know, you're all going to move. That was it.
Walking along the corridor, knocking on doors, stuff like that. They said no. And there's no reason. I mean, if someone just has this lunatic idea to pull down the home that you live in, you haven't denied them, you've been paying the rent, you've been behaving yourself, you've been looking after the property, this and that. They've got no reason to...
Yes, they do. They want to make some money for the private sector.
When someone walks up to you and says, here's $1 billion, I want your son.
You never know in some cases.
Yes, oh, thank you, good deal. But no, not for me. And it's lunatic.
It's lunatic. Do you have children?
Yes.
How many children do you have?
I have a stepdaughter, Kate, and a son.
Right. They'd be getting a bit agey now, wouldn't they? They'd be a bit getting in their 40s and 50s. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, we won't ask about them. But let's go back to this, right? Now, did you know any of the other tenants in your building before the knock on the door?
Yeah.
What, you were talking to people and chatting?
Yeah.
Right.
Chatty man.
Right.
But nothing like what we know each other like now.
Right. So it's, okay, no, we've got plenty of time, step by step. Because the reason I've got you here, Tom, is I've known you for a while, but I bumped into you last Thursday on the steps of Parliament House, and the person who I was going to chat to today had to cancel because of personal issues. So I thought you'd be very good because you're a very positive human being. And currently, there's a lot of long faces and depression and anxiety regarding what's left of the public housing sector. All right, so you got the knock on the door. What's the next thing you did apart from show out of the place? Did you organise a meeting for the flats you're in, or?
Well, we all talked about it.
You talked about it,
yeah,
right?
We talked about it, and the first thing we did was sort of ask everyone in the place,
right?
Do you want to move or do you want to stay?
Mm-hmm.
And we found that the vast majority of people wanted to stay.
Right. And what came after that?
Well, we did a petition,
right,
to save the place. And
who was the petition? Was it addressed to the government, the Victorian government?
It was addressed to the Minister for Housing
at that particular time, right?
Who was Harriet Shinning at that stage? Now it's Nick Stakos.
I assume it was used as toilet paper. Your petition. Did you get a response?
We're going to be presenting this.
Oh, you haven't presented it
to the minister.
So these are the residents in the building.
Yep.
Did you form an association or a group within that building?
Yeah, we have. Once we got this majority,
right.
We had an election,
right,
and elected a residents committee.
Right. Yep. Very democratic.
Yes.
Very exceptional, and that's the way it's done, because that's the strength of that type of resistance. People don't understand that. It's not about somebody saying, let's do this, let's do that. You had meetings, elections. Are you on the committee?
Yes.
What's your role?
Oh, they've asked me to be the chair.
The chair.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Is that because you're a dapper young man?
I'm the tallest. I don't know.
You're the tallest. Right. Because a lot of people there would actually have issues themselves, wouldn't they? Health issues.
Absolutely.
Because it's over 50s. These aren't, you know, young, strapping people. These are people at the end of their life. Many of them are medications. Many of them have got psychological issues because of the type of life they've led. And all of a sudden somebody knocks on your door and says, you're going. So it's just a horrendous situation to be in.
Yeah. You've got these really strong communities there.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a Russian community, you've got something like 30 Russian people in their 90s,
right.
93 years of age. Someone was saying they'd spent 10 years waiting to get in, and when they got their apartment, they just went, oh, thank goodness to the Australian government, and they've been really happy there for 25 years. Mm. And now they say, what am I supposed to say to the Australian government now?
Mm. Mm, the state government, yeah. Have your association, has it got a name? Is it just the Inkerman Street Association, or?
We're the Inkerman Street, the Residents Committee.
Residents Committee. And have you made, are there any other over 50s, you did mention before there are other over 50s housing blocks that are ripe for demolition. Have you made any contact with the other people in the area?
Absolutely. At Albert Park, there are also, super majority of people want to stay, and they've elected a residence committee there too.
Right.
And in Kensington,
right,
the same. And in Flemington, the same.
Right. And now, a lot of people get pressured as they see the excavators on the horizon, and they give up the ghost and move on. And we saw that at Barrack Beacon. There was really, there was over 100 units there. I don't think only one or two actually resisted. Do you think it's going to be any different?
Absolutely.
Why?
Because people are organised and people feel the strength in that united stand. And there's people that say, look, you take me out of here in a box. You know, I'll be here until I die.
Right.
Absolutely committed to staying.
So they're not going. It's not going to be a walkover as it was at Barrack Beacon.
No, because people have gotten organised and people have got to know each other.
Yeah, I think the other difference is that, as you said, most of the people are single and they're elderly. They're over 50. They've got nothing to lose by resisting. A lot of the residents in Kensington and Flemington have got families. And what they're concerned about is if they don't do what the government tells them, they're going to find themselves homeless.
Yeah, but this isn't the case.
That's what I'm saying. It's different. It's a different ball game. You're dealing with.
No, I'm saying that on the record that people who've held out against the department eventually that might offer them something like really good.
Yeah.
When there's nothing else, even if they're the last person there.
Yep. Yeah.
Because the government just really wants to get people out, but we're not going, and there's no good reason for tearing these buildings down in the middle of a housing crisis, in the middle of a debt crisis.
Oh.
The only reason is what you said, Joe, about rich people making much more money.
Yeah, talking about rich people,
yeah.
You and I noticed a little bit of real estate being sold. Now, I was under the impression that the top price that had been paid for a home in Australia was about $45 million down at the Rocks in Sydney. But I've got a little piece of paper here from a real estate agent.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I do have friends in the real estate industry, who's just told me that a property in Toorak called Coonack has just been bought for a record $136.1 million.
It's about three times the price that you thought.
Yeah, and I've noticed there's a lot of it's got a fair bit of area. I mean, that'd be a good place for you people to squat if you were evicted, I reckon.
We're not going anywhere.
You're not going anywhere. All right.
I expect to win.
You expect to win. And what makes you so confident? I know you're the chair of the committee at Income and Street.
So he would say that, wouldn't he?
No, I'm just saying what makes you so confident? Because I was involved in the Barrack
Beacon.
A feeling.
Yeah.
What, you think ethics and morals are going to win over money?
The people are going to win over money.
People are going to win over money.
Life is more valuable than any number in a checkbook.
Yeah, because there's a lot of those communities. I mean, there was another community in Hampton that was knocked down and now has been rebuilt. And I've noticed that they pick their targets quite well. First of all, the walk-ups, and now they're going for the large departments. Because, see, the other thing is that a lot of people, as you know, have no understanding of what the community affordable social housing sector is. It's just private organisations that are funded by the government to provide housing on behalf of the government, you know. And I think a lot of people have been confused, but you're right. I've noticed over the last few months that things are beginning to turn.
Yep.
Because people are beginning to understand that these are private organisations who are actually not providing housing to the people they should be providing housing to. Because there are many over 55 blocks around this city. There's the ones at Fairfield, Williamstown, Port Melbourne. I'm well aware of most of these people because I've been a doctor 50 years and I've visited most of these places as a doctor, you know, after hours, seeing people. And very vulnerable people. So you think they can actually stand up to the government and the courts?
Yeah.
And the police?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I believe just within our block that there's enough feeling and enough strength and unity there. And I know that we've got a lot of people who sympathise with us and the cause and believe that public housing should be expanded, not torn down.
Right.
And that the government never mentions public housing anymore. They only mention social housing and community housing, but they never can't bring themselves to utter the word public
housing. You want to hear something funny? Because I keep an eye on what's happening.
Yeah.
When Albanese was first elected as Prime Minister, you know, by his caucus, they elected him as Prime Minister. For the first 6 months in his first term, he used the term public housing. He really wasn't aware of what was happening in the housing sector, being a public housing tenant,
yep,
raised by a single mother on a, you know, supporting mother's benefit. And about after 6 months, he stopped using the word public. It was all about community, social, affordable, and everybody thinks it's the same thing. It's not.
It's not, no.
You got security of tenure with public housing, unless you trash the place.
Yes.
You could. I've got patients who live in spot purchasing homes around this city, and they've lived in those homes for 30 to 40 years, reared a family, who've gone on and to better things because of the security that public housing gives people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, really valuable, and something we should be expanding and looking overseas to how run effectively places in Europe.
That's right. Isn't it Vienna that half the houses are public homes?
Yeah, incredible. And they have beautiful facilities and it's all...
I had an acquaintance, I wouldn't call him a friend, he was a neighbour, and his mother was elderly and she had a public housing apartment in Paris and he went to look after her in her dying days. He had an ulterior motive. Because as a relative, he could actually apply to keep staying in that home for the next generation. That's how it was.
How good.
Now, Mr. Tom Cooper.
Is this our time?
No. God determines when your time is up, not me. All right.
Now, sorry, I confused you, sir.
Yeah, he confused me. Thank you. Now, Tom, if people want to contact, are you interested in people contacting you?
Yes, by all means.
How do they do it?
Well, they can email me.
Well, you got an email address.
Yeah, yeah. Tom77Cooper@gmail.com.
Tom77Cooper, C-O-O-P-E-R, @gmail.com. Yes, and what else?
And there's a...
you've got another...
Another one, Inkerman.
Yep.
Inkerman at 44fu.org. Org.
FU isn't fuck you, is it?
It's for Flats United.
Oh, Flats United. All right. I thought you were giving them the arse there.
But it has a good ring to it.
It does have a very good ring to it. Takes somebody like me to notice. Well, Tom, look, I wish you all the best. And if we can help in any way, in any of the programs I'm involved in, Henrietta is involved in, let us know.
Yeah, we're gathering next Monday at
where
Fitzroy Town Hall.
Right,
4 till 6.
4 till 6,
and it's be people from 4 estates.
Right,
plus
I think they'll get much more resistance than they expected.
Well, they thought they'll start with the old people. They'll
That's
be a
right.
pushover.
Yeah, yeah.
That'll start the momentum.
Yeah,
and everybody will follow like lemmings.
Yeah, exactly.
But they didn't. They were very quick off out of the blocks to begin with, but then they were a bit slow, and that allowed us the time, thank goodness, to
organize
and get to know each other and really
fight back,
get united.
Well, congratulations! It's been a pleasure and an honour to talk to you, Tom. I'm sorry for the hard questions at the beginning, but if this program will be podcast, there is a picture of Tom. Henrietta's going to put it up in the next few days, and I encourage you to look at the podcast, get in touch with these people. They're wonderful people. They need to be supported because public housing, as we keep saying, is a right, not a privilege. Yeah. Thank you very much, Henrietta.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you very...
And cheerio to all those residents in public housing.
Ah, that are listening to... Oh, there must be at least 4 somewhere. Oh, I just had a silly question. We've got a bloke called Bodorama who rings us from public housing in St Kilda on Talkback with Attitude. Do you know him?
No.
No, because he's a Buddhist, you know, and you've got this Indian philosophy. So I'm sure you're neighbours.
Well, yeah, Odorama.
No, Bodorama.
Oh.
Bodorama, not Odorama. So see if you can find him.
Thank you.
I met him outside the clown face at Luna Park down there. Yeah. Nice bloke.
Thanks, Joseph.
Thank you. Thank you, Henrietta. Thank you, listeners.
Thank you, Neve.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.